back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive, doing what I love to do, mix a little sports, a little political nature, all of it brought to you by our friends at Taharka Ice Cream, made here in Baltimore. Awaken more than just your taste buds, the award-winning ice cream serving up social change. We usually stay here in Baltimore for our guests, and I probably could ship him some Taharka, certainly could ship him some crab cakes from Fadley's, and if he ever gets up here, he's the perfect guy for us to spend a little bit of time with some shrimp and grits. Don Mohler, you've been reading Mark Leibovich for a long, long time, as have I, but the big game caught me a couple of years ago when he went sort of underground into the NFL, into my world, and NFL owners' meetings, now into the back of Jerry Jones's bus. Mohler, if you want a good summer reading book down there on the Eastern Shore, I'm going to recommend The Big Game. It's where sort of politics and Donald Trump and Jerry Jones sort of intersect, so it is my pleasure to welcome Mark Leibovich on the Baltimore Positive for the very first time, but back on to WNST. What's going on? Nothing going on down on the D.C. thing, on the beat down there these days, right?
No, nothing. I'm just wandering the streets, you know? It's oddly quiet, like it is sort of everywhere, I guess. I mean, this is obviously not a normal year, and I was supposed to be doing campaign reporting and Washington reporting, and there's plenty of Washington reporting, but a lot of it's happening sort of behind masks and literal masks as opposed to the figurative masks that we usually have around here. So, you know, it's hot. That happens every summer. And I don't know. It's tiring. I'll tell you that much. I mean, I think I'm just thankful for being able to have a job and being healthy. So, I mean, I'm sort of like everyone else, and hopefully the important categories are taken care of. But no, this is crazy. I mean, Trump is going into some pretty uncharted areas, you know, bringing tanks into streets, and everyone's trying to adapt, and sports is no different. So this is definitely a collision between a lot of worlds, but I wouldn't say anything about it is normal or predictable.
You know, I've been threatening Don for months that I was going to have you on, and I figured whenever we had you on, it'd be interesting. You know, here I am ready to beat you up about the Patriots and Tom Brady and the Red Sox and all that stuff. But, you know, I only had one thing written down, and my only question for you is, what the hell's going on down there? That's all I have for the whole segment. I'm going to let Don handle the rest of it, you know.
Well, Don, you want to take this?
I am going to jump in, Mark, because you started right with my very first note, and that is, you know, I look and I think back. You know, there were rumblings at the time back in the 70s that Richard Nixon had considered martial law, and when he was involved in in impeachment, that was going to be a card that he was going to play. And here we are in 2020, and you know, I had an uncle call me the other day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's getting close to 80 years old. And he just said, does this scare you as much as it scares me? And the reaction that I'm getting from everyone, Mark, is this move of sending some kind of force, we don't even know, I don't think good reporters like you know, into Portland and now maybe other cities. Give us your sense of that. And from a reporter's point of view, what do you make of it?
Well, I mean, it certainly is. I mean, it has the makings of a tip of the iceberg scenario where, you know, I mean, he has sort of rhetorically and politically over the last 3.5 years very much declared war on Blue America. And Blue America, you know, for all intents and purposes, is urban America, right? It's pretty much every city in America over, you know, maybe 150,000. Is either run by or certainly populated by primarily Democrats. And, you know, this, you know, sort of sprouting out from that into the suburbs is the Democratic and progressive base. It is probably much more so the future of America in that, you know, it's much more diverse. Obviously, you know, young people are voting overwhelmingly, you know, much more Democratic than Republican these days. So, I mean, I think in many ways, there's, depending on your perspective, I mean, an optimistic or pessimistic scenario of what Donald Trump has been up to has been just like a last gasp of sort of 1950s Republican America, you know, the sort of mythical America that was supposed to be made great again under Donald Trump, you know, when in fact this is a very different country as we're seeing playing out in friction every single day. And And look, I mean, the great equalizer here and really the great menace here for Trump is the coronavirus, which he has no answer for. And you know, it very well could cost him the election. And no, but I mean, I think no one thinks that these next 6 months are going to be normal or fun or predictable. And hopefully the center will hold in some kind of way that we have an assemblage of a country coming up early next year. But I definitely am hearing similar things, which is that people are really scared and they don't like where this seems like it could be headed. And yeah, I guess we'll see.
The anti-science part of this, Mark, is probably the most demoralizing thing, to think that 63 million people could not just vote for this, go along with this, but then sort of buy into the fact of a hoax is happening around the world. And I've talked to Don at length about this many times, not just in writing books and the literacy of our culture and what is a fact for a journalist and proof of anything, that the internet doesn't have some other OANN, idea about QAnon and all this other nonsense. But more than that, the science of a pathogen that I know it's hard to sort of understand, but it really has been, willful ignorance, literally, by a large, large segment, not only of our population, but where you have Republican leaders in Georgia who don't know what the word asymptomatic means.
Right. No, right. I mean, what's amazing about this whole thing is that, and maybe this is optimistic. I don't think that this sort of no-nothingism is a growth sector in this country. I mean, I think overwhelmingly, I think you mentioned Nixon before. I mean, the difference between now and Nixon's time, Trump's time and Nixon's time, is really, threefold. I mean, one, the internet exists now in a way that is more democratizing to information, good and bad. Fox News exists now, which has created this whole information ecosystem that Trump has certainly tapped into. And
isn't it more of a disinformation ecosystem, really? I mean,
absolutely. I mean, I don't think anyone. I mean, there's all kinds of surveys and science that talk about education levels and sort of informedness levels of people who watch certain shows. So, and also, the third thing is, I mean, I don't think anyone sort of envisioned that the Republican Party would roll over to the degree that it has for Trump, in a way that they didn't for Nixon.
Well, certainly toward the Russians. It's a different thing to say Tricky Dick was looking through some manila folders over at Watergate. I think it's a whole different thing to be in bed with Putin. I mean, and literally signing off on election interference that, Cambridge Analytica, all of that, right?
Right. Yeah, no, there's just a ton. But again, this doesn't happen if the Republicans on the Hill, almost to a person, don't just roll over. I mean, a lot of them, nearly half of them have quit or have been voted out. That's a significant number. But Republicans who remain today are extremely Trumpy. And, they control the Senate and they control, a lot of the country. So,
and a lot of PAC money, international PAC money, from what I understand.
Oh, yeah. Mark. No, I mean, there's a lot of power. Look, I mean, Fox is by far the top-rated cable news network. I mean, the right really controls talk radio, except for you, of course, except for Baltimore.
That's why we exist here.
Exactly. But look, the forces, I think, are pretty clearly drawn, and you do sort of wonder what Republicans' next act would be, in a post-Trump universe, if such a thing were imaginable at this point.
Well, that's a question that I have for you, Mark, and you. Again, you and Nestor have been alluding to it, and that is this whole buy-in on the part of the Republican establishment. And again, Nestor mentions your book, The Big Game. I also am fascinated by the book This Town, where you took a really in-depth look at Washington and the relationships in Washington. And I'm wondering, given the book This Town, could you have predicted an entire party being transformed into what we call the Trump Party as opposed to the traditional small C conservative? Could you see that coming down the pike?
That's a great question. I mean, I'll say this. I mean, what I could see coming was the possibility that some candidate could leverage this utter contempt for Washington and vice versa into a populist candidacy that could shock the world, as Donald Trump did in 2016. I mean, I think when I wrote that book, which was 2013, both in reporting the book and writing the book, but then in sort of seeing how the book was received across the country, which was, you know, far more sort of bipartisan anger and sort of enlightenment, I guess, by, you know, like, geez, we didn't know it was that much of a sort of singular racket, right? So I knew that there was a definite market for what Donald Trump decided to, or was able to tap into. I guess what I didn't fully appreciate when I wrote that book, and that was 7 years ago, was how easy it would be to just to break the whole thing down, and really some of the best guardrails of democracy could just be exploded along with some of the swamp he was allegedly trying to drain, but he hasn't really done that either. So, no, I mean, Washington is basically, I mean, you walk around here, I mean, it's still a really wealthy, comfortable town. I mean, it's weird these days because of the virus, and the virus is hitting us hard like it's hitting everyone hard, but it's basically a very affluent, you know, comfortable city. People here are very comfortable, and the only real difference during the Trump years has been that there's been this big reality show going on in the White House, and the swamp has basically been converted into a gold-plated hot tub, right? But having said all that, I mean, there have been a number of Republicans, mostly people who don't have to run for re-election, who have shown me a fairly impressive amount of spine. You know, many of them are Republican consultants that I totally, you know, had contempt for a few years ago. That I think, you know, have handled themselves well. And again, I don't know if that is a proxy for a lot of former Republicans who live in the suburbs across the country who are going to vote overwhelmingly for Joe Biden and, you know, whoever the next Democrat is. But I think...
Well, Mark, where is the jumping off point for that person? I mean, I've been trying to figure that out. I am waiting for... Yeah. Five Republicans in my world. Five, and I have a pretty sane group for the most part, right, across all socio... Like, they're all white, obviously, right, other than Michael Steele, and we had him on last week. But they're all white. I'm waiting for five of them out of the 100,000 people I know to, like, just drop me a note and say, you know what, I voted for this creep, but I'm not in line with it anymore because it had an R on it, and I thought he ran a legitimate business, and I thought, well, he must be a smart guy. I mean, look, and we find out that he's a real piece of feces, you know, top to bottom, morally bankrupt, all the way around, the Russians freeing Roger Stone, like every part of this, and yet I still don't have anyone who's come back to me on that side and said, I might be wrong. That's rather frightening how far into this we are, 3.9 years, and how far along it is. And really, I thought race would be the jumping off point, Mark. I really thought, like, once he starts talking like that, that we're not going back to George Wallace, I thought that would be the end of him, you know? But there is no end of him.
I would say this. I'm going to push back a little bit because I think that there are quite a few. I mean, the $64,000 question here is, I mean, how many Republicans actually are there and how many exist? Now, a lot of them are appearing in ads. I mean, there's this Republicans Against Trump sort of pack that has been created by the Lincoln Project. You know those guys? They're a bunch of
That's the Steve Schmidt, Bill Kristol group, right?
Bill Kristol, John Weaver, a bunch of pretty well-known Republican media guys, or, you know, consultants, sort of Washington types, who have sort of banded together. They all have no use for Trump, and they have raised a ton of money and made some really good anti-Trump ads. I mean, far better than anything the Democrats, I think, have made. That, you know, granted, have gone pretty viral inside a media ecosystem on Twitter and stuff like that, but they're very effective. I mean, but look, there are some data points that would indicate that a lot of those Republicans who voted for Trump 4 years ago are not going to vote for him this time. And one of the data points is that Republicans have pretty much underperformed in every election since 2016, every special election, every off-year election, certainly the midterm elections. And, you know, Trump's poll numbers have been pretty low from the get-go. He's polling really badly against Biden. And Also, I mean, I saw this stat a couple weeks ago. There was something like basically 48% of all the Republicans in Congress who were in Congress the day Donald Trump was elected have either retired, been defeated, or are not running again right now. So a lot of them are going by way, they're just leaving, and they don't like Trump. I mean, they will say it privately, and they just don't want the hassle of going to war with him privately or publicly because it's not fun. And, you know, they just want to get on with their lives. But the fact is, the Republican Party is shrinking. It's certainly shrinking demographically, and you don't know where their next generation is going to come from because, you know, their thinking has been completely short-term. It's like, what will get me, you know, through the day without getting into a big pissing match with the president? What will get me through my election? Now, you know, a lot of them are in very safe districts, so they can sort of spout off. But it doesn't bode well for the future of that party right now. But obviously, as it's happening, it's scary as hell.
Well, meanwhile, a guy like Hogan's here in Maryland just sort of rubbing his hands together to be the next guy. You know, yeah. Citizens here be damned, quite frankly. We're seeing him on the Love-In tour. He's trying to move into the front seat of that boat now, isn't he?
I think a lot of people are. I mean, Larry Hogan is, you know, he's trying to sort of get into a moderate lane. And, you know, he almost ran against Trump this time. I don't know how serious he was. But, yeah, you know, his whole thing is, look, I've been elected a couple times in a very blue state. I'm pretty moderate. I don't love Trump. I didn't vote for him in 2016. And, you know, I guess he seems to be getting fairly high marks for his coronavirus response. And I guess he's term limited, and he's already talking about running next time. But, no, there are a lot of people. And you know, I just did a story on Liz Cheney and a couple weeks ago, and she's now in the crosshairs of a lot of the other Republicans in Congress for claiming that she's been too critical of Trump and too critical of too praising of Dr. Fauci. I mean, it's just craziness, but I don't know. I just don't really, I guess if you take a long view, it's hard to see how this ends well for this group.
Mark Leibovich is our guest. This Town, The Big Game, The New York Times. You can follow him at Mark Leibovich on Twitter. Go ahead, Don.
Mark, I want you to blow holes in a theory that I have. That this loyalty to Trump is really based on nothing more than political survival driven by the gerrymandered districts that we have all across the country. You had mentioned the fact that most right. of these folks are in safe districts, and whether it's a Lindsey Graham or you name it, any of the other elected across the nation, they have this right. issue that even though the Republican Party may be shrinking, that in a Republican primary, there's incredible loyalty to Donald Trump, and they don't know how to navigate that.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, there is a far bigger threat to their political careers from a right-leaning primary opponent than to the left. I mean, and you're right, I mean, that's a direct result of gerrymandering, which is just sort of basically redesigning a bunch of congressional districts to the benefit of whatever party is in power. So, yeah, no, it's pretty bizarre, but I mean, these people are terrified of losing. I mean, politics is their only game, and it's their sustenance, and it's where their ego is gratified, and it's where their earning power is, both, you know, sort of now and in the future. And, yeah, I mean, it might be distasteful to them privately, but they've all kind of made the same deal. And, you know, maybe what makes them politicians is that they can live with themselves, whereas others might not be able to.
Yeah, it's a fascinating time. The other thing, Mark, that I'm always curious about, Nestor tells listeners all the time that the only thing he ever wanted to be was John Stedman, who's a legendary sports writer here in Baltimore with the Baltimore News American.
Sure.
Curious about
either him or Oscar Madison, by the way. Yeah.
Or Oscar Madison, right? He's Oscar right. also. I'm curious for you, when you were growing up or in school or a young reporter, was there a reporter or someone that you looked up to and said, man, that's who I want to be. I want to write like him. I want to be Jim Breslin, or I want to be whoever.
Oh, man. You know what? To be perfectly honest with you, Don, we know what got me into journalism was I needed a job. I was an English major in college. I was just bouncing around. It was the early 90s. The economy was really in bad shape. And, you know, I got a job answering phones at a weekly newspaper. And that's when I kind of realized that, oh, you know, I'm not making any money, but I kind of like the people I'm hanging around. And But, I mean, eventually when I started reading, I mean, you know, this is Ben Kramer, and he's a Baltimore guy. One of the great political writers, you know, ever, was one of my idols. And then I started reading David Halberstam's books and Kenny Breslin, yes, and I was old enough to know big stuff. But, you know, after you sort of catch the bug, you read as much as you can, and then hopefully you can get yourself some jobs. I mean, a lot of it's just luck. You just sort of hope you get hired in the right places, and, you know, then you get to be in your 50s like I am now and be able to look back and say, huh, someone's actually paid me to do this for a few decades now, and, like, it feels like a real racket. But, I mean, I would say, though, I mean, I don't generally... I have a kind of a short-term survival instinct, which is, what's going to get this story in the paper? Like, what's going to get this blank page filled with a bunch of words, you know? And hopefully there'll be this internal voice that can sort of get me from point A to point B. But I guess sports is my first love. So, I mean, reading the great columnists in you know, the Boston Globe, where I grew up in Massachusetts, and been reading Tom Boswell when I got down to D.C., and you know, Tony Kornheiser and Michael Wilbon, and just everyone. I mean, it's just like a whole crew of these people you admire, and one day, you know, one day you actually get to meet them, and you try not to be too starstruck in the press box, and I don't know. I mean, I wish there were, like, a science to, like, this is what I wanted to be, and how I got there, but you know, it's all, like, one big happy accident, I guess.
Is your process, Mark, in writing a book and writing a column for New York Times Magazine, for the same process, or do you go about it differently?
You know, it's usually the same kind of haphazard process. I mean, I need to just start the story. I mean, you hear people say, "Well, I write the third section first, and then I write an outline, and then I draw it, build a little like a little map on my floor, and then I do this, and then I put this here, and I cut this out here." You know, I need to, like, get a first line, and then a first paragraph, and then first three paragraphs, and then usually after that, maybe 10 paragraphs, I'll have an idea in my head where how I'm going to get, like, to the next section or the next point, and then what I got to do to get myself out of the story, depending on how long it is. I mean, obviously it depends on whether it's a short poem or a longer feature or a book, right? I mean, books are a real bitch because, can I say bitch on this?
You can edit
that if you want.
No, that's good.
But
we bitch a lot here, yes.
There's a lot of words that I can't keep in my head. But there's something a lot of information. I don't have that kind of bandwidth. So you got to sort of, like, wait, did I write that yet? Have I made that point? Or I use that phrase? Or I use that quote? But no, I mean, again, I'm not one of these, like, big fancy outline. I usually don't go in with a plan, except that I have an idea. What I try to do is I try to listen to my own internal voice about what's interesting and what I'm sort of telling my colleagues when I come back to the office after a reporting trip, like what stories I'm telling, what made me laugh, what I'm remembering. That's usually a pretty good indicator of what will be hopefully interesting to readers. I mean, the kind of things that I find myself dwelling on and having other people laugh at and things like that.
This is the point where I promote The Big Game as one of my favorite sports books, certainly of this century. You know, I'm not going to put you up against Semi-Tough or North Dallas 40. That's last century, okay?
No, don't do that.
Or the Bronx Zoo or any of that. Or, you know, so I'm going to move it into this century. Leibovich wrote The Big Game. And, Don, I would tell you, from a football perspective, from an insider who just sort of swooped into what I've been doing for 25 years and really got it right, like all the way down the middle. But I guess this is the point where I start to say to you, well, this Trump thing feels like you sort of doing some sort of Sacha Baron Cohen underground, embed yourself and have some stories or whatever, drinking on Lindsey Graham's bus or something. I don't know, but when it comes to writing this and where you are in the process of what the NFL represents and what Donald Trump represents, I've seen incredible parallels between the way Trump operates and the way Peter Angelos has operated here, a baseball team, for 25 years. I mean, I could write a nice long form story about the parallels between the two of them.
It is pretty amazing. I mean, the thing about being a sports owner is you can't get voted out, right? I mean, if sports owners had to run for re-election, I'm guessing Peter Angelos would not end his job right now.
Oh, you had to push Nestor's button, didn't you, Mark? You had to push
the
button.
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
it's because the Red Sox are playing the Orioles this week. That's what it is.
Do that? Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, this is like, it's hard to get excited about sports. They never have said that before. I mean, baseball season, I mean, part of it might just be Red Sox would be terrible, but also, how's this going to work with no fans? And, you know, I'm pissed off at the players, and I'm pissed off at the owners, and the fact that it's taken this long. And I don't know, it just doesn't seem like a great sport for, I mean, I guess any sports would be welcome at this point, but that is not something I can get excited about. The NFL, I don't know how they're going to pull this off. The NBA might have a shot. I mean, this bubble thing seems like it's going fairly well, and there's a lot of, most people are testing negative. I guess everyone tested. All the players yesterday tested negative for the virus, which was a surprise. But no, I mean, look, I mean, everything is kind of an empire, right? An empire's end. And the question is, you know, what empire is going to end first? And obviously, you know, with Trump, there's an election, which is always a natural end point, or certainly a natural inflection point for when empires end. But, you know, sports, I think, are going to always be, you know, have a pretty powerful hold on the American psyche. But, I mean, nothing is forever, and I think the NFL might learn that, you know, in the next few decades now, and they're not a terribly well-run league, as, you know, I was able to explore both between the commissioner and the owners. And,
should have done more on Dan Snyder down there, Mark.
Oh, man. He had a really rough week last week, huh? I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, and this sort of goes to how petty and you know, miserable I am, but I can never root for the team. This is like a mark of like a true Boston fan. I can't move anywhere else and hope anyone can be happy. So it's always fun to see the Redskins deteriorate to the degree that they have. I know so many unhappy Redskins fans over, you know, what's gone on with that franchise over the last, you know, couple, you know, since I've moved here. And that's actually been kind of fun to follow. But wow, even for them, I mean, this has been a bad few weeks.
Mark, we appreciate it. Go ahead, Don. Wrap it up for us.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, well, I have two quick things, Nestor.
Sure.
One, Mark, you touched on it in your book, The Big Game, and that is the whole threat to football. And I think you used Favre and I forget who the other quarterback was, who was concerned about their own children playing football. I hear that all the time from young moms and dads. How big a threat is that to the game, Mark?
No, it's a huge threat. I mean, it's a huge threat. I mean, there's no way you're going to be able to make football safe. I mean, forget the coronavirus. I mean, it's a whole other category. I mean, look, no one walks away unscathed, and you know, the participation numbers on letting kids play football are just way down. And, you know, I don't think that's going to immediately eliminate the talent pool. But, I mean, I don't think it's like a 10, 20-year threat, but it's certainly a 40, 50-year threat. But the other thing is, you know, things turn really, really quickly. I mean, one of the lessons of this summer and has been just how fast sensibilities have changed around race, around things like the Redskins' names and the Confederate flag in Mississippi, and where people are in polls as far as race relations. I mean, I think one of the things Trump has done is he's tried to sort of run against a backlash to all of these protests, and it hasn't really existed. And I think that's been a real stunner. So, I mean, who's to say that, like, people might just decide to turn against football for any number of reasons? And football could take a serious hit. I mean, look, I mean, who's to say? I mean, there's no question in my mind that a whole bunch of players are going to kneel to the national anthem, you know, if they ever start games. And you know, how's the predominantly conservative fan base of the NFL going to handle that? I mean, Trump has already said he's taking a walk.
We saw NASCAR fans boo Bubba Wallace and hold up the Confederate flag. So I think that's if past prologue, I think we get a view of what's going to happen.
Well, I mean, NASCAR, though, I mean, talk about, I mean, I never followed NASCAR. It's never really been my thing. But, I mean, from the outside, just I think the leadership of NASCAR has taken an incredibly courageous stand on this stuff this summer. I mean, I don't know. I mean, well, actually, I guess they've had really big ratings.
Well, they've taken a much bigger stand than, let's say, Mitch McConnell has, right?
Well, or Roger Goodell.
Or, Goodell
did this recovery tour this summer a little bit. But no, I mean, like that to me, and again, I don't, that's not something I follow closely, but I was stunned by that. And you know, again, like Mississippi, just to saying, you know, on one hand, it's like, oh my God, they saw the Confederate flag and their state flag. Like, what's that about? But I mean, yeah, look, it just happened. So, you know, a lot of this out in the open. And I think one thing that we've learned, when things get out in the open, things do tend to change faster. So, I mean, we'll see where the NFL is on the other end of all this.
Don, you got any more for Mark? Go for it.
I got one last thing. That's right. I love it because Mark's been I want to get his take. He's been an outspoken critic of sort of a Washington tradition, and that is the one and only Correspondents' Dinner. And you have not been a fan of David Gregory doing a dance up there with Carl Rove. It hasn't floated your boat. Is that safe to say?
No. Yeah, no, there's a whole bunch of we're all part of the same deal, we're all part of the same party. But that's one of the good things about the pandemic is all this stuff's been canceled this year. So you don't have to worry about it.
What was it, Mark, as a journalist that rubbed you the wrong way about the Correspondents' Dinner?
Oh, just the whole thing, just coziness. I mean, what exactly are we celebrating? It's not like, you know, like Washington's like beloved and doing all these great things. And like, you know, I think journalism is the greatest profession ever, but you can only celebrate yourself so many times a year. And like, you know, we get the Pulitzers and, you know, we basically get to like write stuff and get paid for it. So that's enough of a scam. What do we need to like celebrate all the time?
We're trying to keep the Baltimore Sun in business around here so they can win more Pulitzers and bring down more corrupt mayors. You know what I mean?
It's a great newspaper. At least it was. I mean, it's like a lot of newspapers gone on hard times. I mean, everyone should subscribe to a newspaper. I don't care what it is.
Amen.
Appreciate you, Mark. Thanks for coming on and always answering the call and the big game. And paperback now, is that correct? We can still get it?
Oh, yeah, it's in paperback. And, yeah, it's all out there. And, yeah, you know, support. Look, these are it's a good time to read. Like, you can read in private. You don't have to breathe on anyone. You don't have to be breathed on by anyone. You can do it with air-conditioned. Well, the book is air-conditioned, but there are spaces that are air-conditioned. So, so buy the book. But either way, everyone be well. And Nestor, thanks for having me on. Don, great to meet you, and we'll do it again.
Well, I hope so.
Safe.
Mark Leibovitz joining us here, the big game, our town, all that good stuff, the New York Times. You can find him out on Twitter at Mark Leibovitz. And you know, good books are sold. And when they shut the NFL down in Week 5 because of COVID, you'll have a good NFL book to read, The Big Game. I highly recommend it. Don Moeller, former Baltimore County executive, and myself, all of our sponsors, Taharka, made in Baltimore, the Honey Graham ice cream and the Graham cracker swirl, using the award-winning ice cream to serve up social change, our friends at Taharka. Don't forget State Fair out in Catonsville and the new El Guapo, named after me. Thank you very much, Evan Brown. That's opening later on in the month. We'll get some pupusas, some margaritas, and some tacos as well. Shipping crab cakes all over the world. That's what they do at Fadley's of Lexington Market. Gosh, we miss our like sit-downs with Damie, and we had Brandon Scott down there. He's about to become mayor. We hopefully get back down there again next year. You can ship those Fadley's crab cakes anywhere in the world. Don't forget Moeller and Gary Realty. Jeff Moeller joined me for a spirited, lengthy chat about the market and low interest rates and buying and selling homes here in the Charm City. You can find that out in the buyatoyota.com audio vault as well, and find Jeff at moellerandgary.com. I am Nestor. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller, we are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, calm, local, Baltimore positive.